Hi, this is Cynthia Davis. It's time to wake up the sleeping giant. We're in a culture war, but in this episode, we share some secrets for how to win. Don't let the bullies get you down. Tonight, I bring you a credentialed psychologist who will explain the deeper issues, the tactics, and what we can do next. Welcome to Homefront on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I'm Cynthia Davis, your host. As a writer, speaker, and former legislator, we discuss limiting government, fiscal responsibility, and fair taxation. I'm a mother of seven and a wife of one for over three decades, so I bring you my personal experience. And now it's time for Homefront with Cynthia Davis. Welcome to Homefront. Today we have a very special guest, Tim Daughtry. Dr. Daughtry is a former clinical psychologist turned conservative writer and speaker. He is the co-author of Waking the Sleeping Giant, How Mainstream Americans Can Beat Liberals at Their Own Game. So welcome, Dr. Daughtry.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm honored that you, before you got into your foray into politics, you were a psychologist. So did you have people lay on your couch in your office and you listen to them tell you all their problems?
Actually, in my practice, they sat on the couch, but yeah, that's basically what clinical psychologists do, and I enjoyed that for a number of years, but eventually I was in an organization. I got promoted into management, and from management moved into my consulting career, and that really is what sort of made the bridge into politics, because in business consulting, you think in terms of the importance of strategy and the importance of maintaining your composure when you're under pressure, and as my partner and I began to notice the trends that were going on in the country, particularly after 2008, we began to realize, wait a minute, there are a lot of parallels here, and the conservative movement in particular needs to begin to think in terms of what is our strategy, where are we going. The other pattern we noticed is that a lot of really good conservatives need to learn how to get off the defensive. It's the kind of thing we talk with business executives all the time about when people are on defensive, when they're in a defensive position, whether it's in a business meeting or whatever, you're at a disadvantage. And that's a major point of Waking the Sleeping Giant, is that the conservative movement historically has been a defensive movement. And that, I think, is one of the primary things that we need to change in this country.
We saw this in 2012 when there were a lot of Tea Party activist-type people who suddenly woke up during the Tea Party movement in 2009 and then 2010, but that was still young in the movement. So a lot of people thought we can rev up and really engage for 2012. The momentum will continue. I was reading inside your flap of your book where you very eloquently say this: the republic created by our founding fathers is on the brink of political and economic ruin. We cannot count on politicians to put America back on a sound course, since the government grows and liberty shrinks regardless of which party we put in power. As mainstream Americans, we know what is wrong with our country, and we know that the leftist policies are the problem, but the ruling class believes the mainstream is irrelevant as a political force, when we are actually the backbone of the body politic. We work, we pay our taxes, we vote, and then we go back to work and hope those in power will do the right thing. We have trusted the dogs of the political class to guard our lunch, and they have eaten it. You say that so well because we have done that. So going back to what happened in 2012, we saw a lot of good conservatives get blown away, totally, not even close. We saw in Missouri, Missouri is a state that has a Republican House and Senate, and therefore you would think that being the freedom-loving state that we are, we would be capable of electing a Republican to our U.S. Senate, but no, Claire McCaskill beat Todd Akin by a very large margin. We couldn't even elect a Republican Secretary of State for an open seat. The incumbent was leaving office. It was up for grabs. I worked with Shane Scholer in the House of Representatives, and I can vouch for his character. The man is very godly and would have made an amazing Secretary of State. There is no reason for us to have turned him down. Even our Attorney General's race, which, you know, Attorney General is very important, and we had a really bad Attorney General who refused to give a legal opinion to the House members, and that is one of the duties of the Attorney General. I can't believe we had a very good candidate, Ed Martin, who was a respected lawyer. He's run for office before, and he couldn't win that seat. On top of that, we saw a very good senator, a champion of the Constitution, and the incumbent not even be able to hang on to his seat. So we are clearly losing. We're losing this country. Of course, Obama got another term, which is a shock to people who observe. My question is, how is it possible that we're winning the debate but losing the republic?
I think that's the key question, and I think after years of really studying this and being involved in politics, and of course looking at it partly with my background in psychology, there's an underlying dynamic. A debate always happens at two levels. First off, there's the content of the debate. That's what you're actually talking about, and it can be anything. It can be immigration. It can be healthcare. It can be any topic, but there's always the underlying dynamic, basically, of who is in charge of the conversation, who is on offense and who is defense, particularly in a political discussion. And if you really look back over our history, the conservative movement is almost always in a defensive position. And I think that's in part who we are as conservatives. I mean, that's what conservatism means. It's to protect, to defend. We defend the Constitution. We defend liberty. We defend free enterprise. Social conservatives defend the Judeo-Christian foundations on which the country was founded, and we try to protect society against radical social movements that are going to create instability and that historically have not been good for society. So we're almost always in a defensive position. And Cynthia, you touched on something earlier that I think is very important. It's kind of in the character of mainstream Americans to mind our own business. That's what we do. We want certain laws, but those are based on things that are widely agreed upon. But basically what I mean by that is that if you don't like Duck Dynasty, you just change the channel. If a conservative wants contraceptives, they get out and get a job and they buy their own contraceptives. This idea of forcing other people not to watch something or forcing other people to provide something for you, that's a very liberal idea. Conservatives mind their own business. And Cynthia, here's the key point. Minding your own business is not a political strategy. It always puts us in a defensive position, and all of the initiatives come from the far left. Obamacare, gun control, the global warming business, everything basically is coming from amnesty. Everything, all of the political initiatives come from the left. So if you really want to think about it, the left is always in sort of a prosecutor role and we're in a defendant role. Even think about the symbols that we use that we march under, if you will, the forward symbol of the Obama campaign. Now, that came from the old European socialist, and, we know the history on that. But think about what the forward symbol connotes. It basically says, we have a plan, we have an agenda, we have a strategy, and we're on the move. Now, think about the Tea Party's popular slogan, and I love to see it. I love to see the don't tread on me. When you pull into a parking lot and you see two or three of those, you know they're friendlies there. But think about what Don't Tread on Me actually says, though. It says that I'm going to mind my own business unless you get in my turf, unless you get in my face or get in my turf. I'm basically going to mind my own business. It's an inherently defensive position. Cynthia, I think the thing that the conservative movement has to do, and we're running out of time to do it, we have to begin to get off the defensive. We have to stop just defending liberty and start promoting liberty. We have to move from a negative movement that says no to the left's agenda to a positive movement that actually gets out into our culture and once again teaches people the benefits of liberty, teaches people the importance of our Judeo-Christian foundations. If we don't get off the defensive, I think the country's lost.
I agree. I appreciate your illustration about how we like to be left alone and how others who oppose our values don't want us to be infusing them with our philosophy. I've run for office many times, and whenever you mail out campaign literature, you know a certain percentage of the pieces are going to go in the trash. The media managers say you get about 3 seconds before it goes in the trash, and we love that people have the freedom to do that. I had an irate constituent call me one time, and he said, "Take me off your mailing list. I don't want to get any more of your political mail." And, of course, you and I know that he signed up to get political mail the day he registered to vote. But my husband...
That's called being a citizen.
Yes. My husband talked to this one constituent, and he said, "Listen, I've got two deals for you. Number one is I can drive over to your house and take the piece back out of your mailbox. If you want to give it back to me, I'll come and pick it up." And the other one is, he said, "We could save both of ourselves a lot of time. I'm going to give you permission to throw it out. Go ahead."
In other words, take some responsibility and change the channel.
"I will not hold it against you if you put it in the trash." But we are trying so hard to connect. We know that we have to communicate if we're going to change anything. We're not going to change the world by hunkering down, living in a cave, being isolated. We have to infuse the culture with a conscience. That's what we are. We show the way of what is right and wrong. And if we will have this mentality of we all leave each other alone, how then are we going to impact the culture? How does it work if we're going to stay wrapped in our own cocoons? So in politics, you say good citizens make great losers. How does that happen?
It's because of what we just touched on, that a good citizen, if you really think about it, think about the way we're raised. I mean, we're good citizens when we're in school, and we're taught, you know, you don't get into fights at recess, you follow the rules, you do your homework, you clean up after yourself. We're taught from childhood, mainstream Americans are taught from childhood, basically to be good citizens in the broad sense of the word. And a lot of that has to do with minding your own business, not sticking your nose into other people's business, cleaning up after yourself, if you will, taking care of yourself. And that's a great way to be. We need to teach children to be that way. We need to teach, we need more good citizens in society. That's the backbone of society. However, politically, that does not create a political strategy. Minding your own business is not a political strategy. William F. Buckley, I think very appropriately, said when he was launching National Review back in 1955, he said, "The job of National Review is to stand athwart history yelling stop." And what he meant by that is that the nature of the conservative movement, going back to Edmund Burke and the great early conservatives, the nature of the conservative movement has always been to resist the radical changes of the day, or at best, with industrialization and demographic changes and things like that, to channel those changes into the traditions on which society is based. So it's to minimize chaos, it's to preserve the best of our past, but once again, standing athwart history and yelling stop, and of course he was being somewhat facetious with that, but that is an inherently defensive position. That's what the Tea Party basically is doing. We're standing athwart the radical left's agenda these days and saying stop. You know, we don't want Obamacare. We don't want amnesty. And I think that's what I mean when I say that good citizens make great losers. is that just saying stop always means you're in a defensive position. Think about what that really means. It means when we're defending, when we're constantly in a defending position, it means we have to win every encounter with the left or we lose ground. Being on offense, the left only has to win occasionally. It doesn't matter how many times they challenge traditional marriage in court and lose. They only have to win once, and then that becomes a precedent. It doesn't matter how many times they pushed Hillary Care and other efforts like that and lost. They only had to win Obamacare one time. And so what I've really been pushing and talking to groups around the country is that it's great to be good citizens. It's great to mind your own business. That's at the heart of being a good citizen, I think. However, when it comes to politics, we need to change our mindset, and we need to realize that we have to have a positive agenda and not just a negative agenda. And I don't mean by that compassionate conservatism. I don't mean basically big government with conservatives running it. What I mean is that liberty works. Free enterprise creates the most prosperous society, not only for the rich, but also for the poor. You know, the rich are all, the liberals are always talking about how, well, when you have free enterprise, the rich get richer. Well, that's true. But what they don't tell us is that the poor do better. We've seen this in India. We've seen this in China when they have reduced state controls and allowed more market forces to take place. And I don't think we as conservatives do a good enough job of getting out and making that case to people. And there's a number of reasons for that we can get into, but the big one being that we have surrendered control of our cultural institutions to the far left.
Well, let's talk about that for 1 minute. We seem to have a one-way street. When I got into the Missouri State Legislature, the budget was smaller than what it was when I left 8 years later. We have term limits in Missouri, so 8 years is all you can do, and then you have to go bless the world somewhere else. But if you were going to compare where my own freedom-loving state was when the Republicans took the majority versus what it was like when I left and the Republicans still had the majority, that group of people grew government bigger, more intrusive, and more expensive. So you say on the flap of your book, here's your quote again, it says, "We cannot count on politicians to put America back on a sound course since the government grows and liberty shrinks regardless of which party we put in power." So these Tea Party folks thought they could put good people in power and then government would shrink. But it is a one-way street. It grows bigger all the time. And I've had people tell me that now that Obamacare is here, we'll never get rid of it because now people are becoming dependent on it. How do you change the trajectory? If it's already on a course, how do you shrink it without seeming uncompassionate?
Well, I think awareness is the first major step there, being aware that what we're doing isn't working. And the good news, Cynthia, is I'm seeing that all around the country. At the grassroots level, when you're out talking to rank-and-file conservatives, and I'm talking Tea Party as well as the formal Republican Party, there's a growing recognition of just exactly what you just described. Wait a minute, something isn't working. It's one thing if government gets bigger or the budget goes up as the economy grows, but you just mentioned the key word. It's not just that government grows as the economy grows. Government gets more intrusive. That's the problem. It's that liberty is actually shrinking. You know, we're going to have, you know, government functions are going to be larger. You know, you're going to have a larger highway department as a state grows and you have more highways. That's fine. The problem isn't always with the size of government. The real problem is the intrusiveness. And that's the part that you just hit it on the head. What we have done as conservatives typically is we put people in office and then we say, we'll see you in 2 years, best of luck. And politicians don't get reelected by saying no. They're faced with lobbyists. And the other point, too, is when they're hearing from constituents during in between elections, the left does a better job of lobbying and putting pressure than we do. That's why it's always our folks that cave. In Obamacare, you notice there was always a big discussion before the Supreme Court ruling about whether Anthony Kennedy would turn. Now, nobody anticipated John Roberts, I don't think. But the real concern was whether one of the conservative appointees, or appointed by Republicans, would turn. Notice there was never any question whether the four liberals would turn. There was never any question that those four votes were solid. And I think you just hit on what our major problem is. We put people in office and then we say, okay, go, you know, do your best job and we'll see you in a couple of years. That's what we've got to change. Conservatives have to realize that politics is 24/7. We've been like summer tourists. You know, we go to election like it's going on vacation. And then when it's over, we go home. Well, the left stays behind. And that's what one thing we've really got to change is the conservative, and I'm seeing this with grassroots movements, the grassroots movement is realizing this is 24/7. We have to put people in office and then, number one, support them when they're under pressure. I don't think we've done a good enough job when they're being hammered by the left. Support them and give some friendly fire protecting them. But the second thing is we have to remind them that we put them in office and we can take them out. I mean, that's the nature of politics. And I don't think we've done a good enough job. I'm beginning to see that change. Cynthia, there's an easy example I want to tell you before it slips my mind. Think about a year back. Social conservatives all over the country showed up at Chick-fil-A. You remember that day?
I do.
I mean, a lot of us were just eating chicken until we were growing feathers, right? Because we were protecting Chick-fil-A. We were standing for traditional marriage. But remember, where did we go the next day?
Where did we go?
We went back to work. We were there at Chick-fil-A for one day. We made our point. We flexed the muscle. But then we go back to work. What does the left do? The left works in our schools. They work in the news media. They're writing the copy for the situation comedies that our children are watching. And gradually they embed their values over time. And they do it every day, 365 days a year, a little bit at a time. Conservatives have to realize that politics is about far more than winning elections. What good is it going to do us, Cynthia, to win elections if the people who lost the election are teaching our children, reporting the news, and writing the scripts in Hollywood? It's just a matter of time. We're trying to win elections. The left is focused on winning the next generation. And that's why I really try to hammer the point that conservatives have to realize that the political struggle is really in the culture. It's in our cultural institutions.
Well, my family members were waiting in line at Chick-fil-A. It wrapped around the building. They went for the fun of it. It was a cultural experience. It was an opportunity to network. They didn't mind waiting an hour and a half because they created an event and it was fun. I remember asking one of my campaign staff members if he could tell me what do we need to do to get more volunteers, and he said, well, it has to be fun. I think we're so used to fun and being entertained, and you know, if you've ever run a campaign, I'll tell you, half the people who say, can I help you, really don't mean that. They say that to be nice, but you wrote...
Doesn't mean I'll pray for you, which is good, but it's not the same as walking door to door and meeting voters.
Hi, friends. Do you like what you're hearing? Then go to my website. It's CynthiaDavis.net and sign up for my newsletter. You'll get all this information and more when you sign up for my email reminding you of when you'll hear another podcast and letting you know what's coming up next. Besides, we always have a little bit of humor at the end, so go to CynthiaDavis.net and stay in the loop. For those of you who don't like email, go to my Facebook page. It's called Homefront with Cynthia Davis. And make sure you click the like button. That way, you'll have a convenient way to see what we're doing and to get the word when another podcast is released. That's Homefront with Cynthia Davis on Facebook. My website is CynthiaDavis.net. That's where we keep all our good stuff. So if you want to get our newsletter and find more podcasts, go to CynthiaDavis.net Hey, let's stay in touch. You wrote a chapter called I'm Not a Marxist, But I Vote Like One, and I want to tell you the Santa Claus story, because government is not Santa Claus. One of my friends on Facebook wrote this story about how cool it was that the fire trucks came through her subdivision right before Christmas, and they had Santa Claus on the back, and he was passing out candy canes to all the children, and how fun that was. And I can't deny that that sounds like a very fun idea. But if that's what we want government to do for us, to be our Santa Claus and to pass out candy canes, and these, I bet you most of the people who call themselves conservative listening to this think, isn't that nice that they're passing out candy canes? Well, wait, that's way outside the scope of government. Now, no elected official is going to stand up and say, let's not have Santa Claus anymore and let's not have candy canes. Nobody has the bravery to explain that that's not what we're hiring government to do for us. And yet, this is the problem. We get people into office, wear ourselves out to get good people into office, and then they all love being the Santa Claus for their district. How can we change that dynamic so that people want liberty again? So people say, I want to have a government, not a Santa Claus.
Great question, and I think the answer to that has two prongs. The first one is short-term, because the reality is that the left has been carrying out what they call a long march through the cultural institutions. The long march began way back over 100 years ago with progressivism, Fabian socialism. It picked up again in between the 30s and the 60s with cultural Marxism. By the way, that is one that I think has been a tremendously effective movement that is underestimated. Mainstream America doesn't know about cultural Marxism. It's had a tremendous effect on our culture, but it's been a long, long, long march. So that long march is almost completed. They've been moving toward European-style socialism, and with Obamacare, we're one step away. Obamacare, I think, is the next to the last step before we get to European-style socialism. And so we have to realize that the first the first part of our strategy, I think, has to be that we've got to stop the advance. And so there's some things that we can do there. One of the big ones is to take back control of our language. Words like compassion, words like diversity, words like tolerance, words like fairness. The left has deliberately taken over those words. Those are Judeo-Christian words, by the way. The Judeo-Christian worldview teaches fairness. You know, it's not fair for one person to work for something and then somebody to take it from them. That's not fair. You know, we are tolerant. We may disagree with somebody's behavior, but we certainly respect their personal rights. You know, they're children of God. They will answer to God. And so, you know, we don't by force and coercion convert people. We don't by force and coercion make them do what we want to do. So the left, however, has taken words like choice. The only time the left allows choice is abortion. Every other element of liberal politics is about coercion, not choice. But I think because we've been so busy doing our jobs and paying our taxes and taking care of our families, we've let the left do this sort of under our noses, if you will. So the first thing I think is we've got to change our strategy. We've got to go on offense. We've got to take back our language. And the first step has to be we have got to stall the left's long march. I think there's an opportunity here with Obamacare. I realize the deck is probably stacked against us, but if we can turn Obamacare back, and that would be the first time we have really taken a major leftist initiative and not only stopped it, but turned it back. If we can repeal Obamacare, that will be a tremendous, tremendous step.
Do you think that's realistic, though?
I think the odds are against us, but I think it is possible. The way our current politicians, particularly the Republican Party, the way they currently work, is what happens is the left gains ground, and then if it's something like Obamacare that currently looks like a catastrophe, then the Republicans come in and fix it. They mend it. They make it more efficient. They make it work better. And to me, that's the worst thing they can do right now. So I think there is a chance, and that's kind of a side note, but I think the thing that we've got to do right now is, first off, don't wait until election time. I think the Republican strategy right now is let Obamacare do its damage. Let people be frustrated with it. Let them, you know, just don't try to fix it. Just sit back and wait, and then the Democrats will be vulnerable in 2014. I don't think that's going to happen. Remember, Obama got reelected, and he got reelected with gas prices that had doubled, with unemployment that was skyrocketing, national debt that was skyrocketing, and scandal after scandal in his government. People just get used to it, okay? So I think the strategy, and this is part of the first step, the short-term strategy of turning back the assault, I think the strategy has to be certainly to hammer what's wrong with Obamacare, but there are a lot of good conservative solutions. Now, they may not be ideal, and it still involves the federal government and health care, but the federal government's involved in health care right now. We've got to gain back some ground. Heritage Foundation has what I think are some very workable solutions: portability of health care, pushing the authority back to the state level, which is a major conservative concern, do block grants to the states, let the states figure out Medicare and Medicaid as it best works for them. Let states do high-risk insurance pools. Now, granted, Cynthia, that's still the government being involved in health care, but it is a step back toward federalism. It's a step back toward the states having more power than the federal government. It reduces the grip of the federal government. To me right now, that's an important strategic move. Now we may then at the state level begin to figure out how do we further privatize health care. But I think right now that's the best shot we've got for breaking the stride of Obamacare. But we have to have an alternative. We have to offer an alternative. Because the other strategy is to realize on the left, the left strategy is, and I fully believe this, from the left's point of view, Obamacare is not a disaster. Obamacare has followed the Cloward-Piven strategy of creating chaos. It's pushing people out of their health insurance. It's making health insurance unaffordable. It's creating chaos in the system. Insurance companies don't know who's signed up and who hasn't. I mean, there's chaos. Well, what's going to happen? That's the whole Cloward-Piven strategy. What's going to happen when there's chaos? The left is going to come in and say, whoa, we need government to fix this chaos. Now, they created the mess, and now they're going to say what we need is a single-payer system to fix it. So I think the Republicans, if they wait for election 2014, I think they're going to have missed the window. People will be used to bad health care by then, and the left will be saying, okay, it's a mess, but we know how to fix that. Let's just move to a single-payer system. So my point was that I think the first prong in our strategy has to be to stall the left's advance right now, and I think Obamacare is probably one of the biggest opportunities we're going to have to do that. Now, the second one, and Cynthia, this is the one that it concerns me to even have to say it, because this is not conservatives, this is not our strong suit. We're going to have to realize that in order to regain ground, we're going to have to mount our own long march through the cultural institutions. It's going to have to start with education. It's going to have to start with our seminaries. It's going to have to start in our cultural institutions. We're going to have to begin to take back our culture. Because let's get back to your example about the Santa Claus. If a politician were to stand out and say, wait a minute, Santa Claus shouldn't be riding on the back of a government-funded truck, that's sending the wrong message, a government-funded fire truck, imagine what the news media is going to say about that person. That politician is going to be taken out of context, and they're going to be treated like a Grinch trying to steal Christmas. So the only way to handle those kinds of situations is what we call immersion, not conversion. If children are raised from early on realizing what the role of government is and what the role of government isn't, then they will be the ones to say, wait a minute, Santa Claus shouldn't have anything to do with government. You know, we shouldn't be handing out candy canes from a fire truck. But that's the only way to do that. The strategy is called immersion instead of conversion, and that's what the left does. That's why they targeted our schools. That's why they targeted our seminaries. Children go to school, and they think they're learning math. But then I read recently an example of how a liberal teacher in a math class gave students the assignment of, okay, you got $100 and you got 100 people. Now, your assignment, class, is that one person has $40 and the other 99 have to divide up the $60. So how much does each person get out of that 99 if they're dividing up the $60? Now, Cynthia, that looks like a math lesson, but what's the underlying message there? And this is what I mean by immersing children in left-wing dogma. The underlying message is all about the unfairness of our economic system. It's all about redistribution. What, the 1% has $40, the 99% have to divide up the remains, as if our economic system was simply dividing up money. And the children don't realize when they're doing the math assignment, they don't realize they're being taught a political lesson. That's immersion. It just seeps into their awareness. That's what we've got to reverse, Cynthia. We have got to get back to the point that we're teaching children that the founders of this country were heroes. We've got to get back to the point that we're teaching them personal responsibility. And using the example that I just talked about, the economic example, we have to begin to teach children that when we talk about rich and poor in this country, we're not really talking about two classes of people for the most part. Rich and poor really are the same people at different stages of life. A 20-year-old doesn't usually have the resources that a 60-year-old has after 40 years of working and saving and investing and buying a house. And so when the left just kind of immerses children in this language of, oh, well, the rich have this and the poor don't have enough, they're glossing over the fact that, wait a minute, if you're born in poverty and you don't use drugs, you don't get into alcohol, you stay in school, and you don't have children until you get married, even if you're born in poverty and your early life is in poverty, you're very unlikely to be in poverty later. That we're not teaching that in our schools right now. We're not teaching that in our cultural institutions. And that's what I mean when I say conservatives have to get off the sofa and get out into politics, get to the school board, get to the state legislatures, just begin to immerse people in our culture in the benefits of free enterprise and the benefits of liberty.
That's excellent. You know, you say that we need to face our fear of disapproval and social unpleasantness. Can you explain the anatomy of the appeasement cycle?
Oh, a great question. The appeasement cycle basically is what we have seen over and over, and I've taught this all over the country. It's basically when you've got a small number of people with an agenda, and that's typically the left, and you've got a majority that just wants to be left alone, you see a particular cycle there. The ones with the agenda put on pressure. They intimidate, they call names, they demand. It's the same dynamic that you see with a toddler in a store with tired parents. The toddler wants something, and they create a ruckus. The parents are tired. And, you know, so early on we try to reason, we try to explain, we try to compromise. Eventually what happens is we give in, and that's the appeasement cycle. The left puts pressure. We try to reason. We try to explain. We say we can't afford that. That's not constitutional. They start calling us names. They start intimidating, and eventually we back down, and then the cycle repeats. The anatomy of the appeasement cycle is that we are designed that part of our brain is for reasoning. Part of our brain we use when we're thinking rationally, when we're having an intelligent discussion. Then you see a lot of activity in what we call the cortex. It's the front part of the brain. When something triggers a defensive response, you say, imagine you're walking to your car at night and it's dark and you hear footsteps behind you. We're designed so that your brain will switch into defensive mode, and that's to help you survive. The blood goes to the deeper part of the brain, the emotional part of the brain, and it begins to wire us for defense, if you will. Our heart rates pick up, our mouth gets dry, our muscles get tight, and that makes perfectly good sense when the threat is a physical threat. Unfortunately, the same thing happens when the threat is a social threat. So if you're discussing something with a liberal and they start making accusations, they say, well, why don't you want poor people to have health care? What have you got against immigrants? And they begin to, at least symbolically, they get in our face, if you will, or metaphorically, they get in our face. Well, the blood goes to the defensive centers of our brain. And when that happens, we fall back on old patterns, and the patterns are typically defensive. The other thing that happens is that you don't think as clearly. You know, if you're running from an attacker, in the wild, or if you're protecting yourself, you don't have to think clearly. You just have to be strong and fast, and we're designed for that. The left has learned to use that. That's why they call us names. That's why they make accusations. It's why they're constantly on attack, so that we'll get flustered, we'll get frustrated, our minds will go blank, and that's part of the anatomy of the appeasement cycle. And when I mentioned that our fear of disapproval, mainstream Americans are raised to want to get along. We're the peacekeepers. We love peace. We love harmony. If you've got one left-winger in a Sunday school class and they start harping on social justice, if you've got nine moderate to conservative people there, usually the moderate to conservatives will sit back quietly rather than to create a scene. And that's part of the anatomy of the appeasement cycle. I've said over and over, the left has learned to use our maturity and our decency against us.
They sure have. Before I was in the legislature, I was on the city council. You know, just to encourage our listeners that there's benefit in getting engaged in any component of government. What you just said about going to school board meetings and the city council, the same themes emerge: growing government bigger and more intrusive, more expensive, happens everywhere. It's just with the state, it's on a larger scale, and federal government, it's even larger yet. I was on the city council, and I remember seeing bad ideas emerge and thinking, well, if I don't raise my hand and question this, nobody else is going to question it. And there was such an intimidation factor, and I've always been raised to be a nice person, and it tortured me to have to raise my hand right before they're going to vote on government takeover of our trash collection, or should government build more rec centers, and all these same ideas. Should we raise taxes on people's mobile phone bills? I mean, these are things that were bad things, and yet the disdain I received from the mayor and the other seven members was a cost that I had to calculate, and it was painful. And all I did to offend them was ask questions, for goodness sake. I never was mean or name-calling. We always stayed polite, kind, cordial, civil on my end. But by the time I left city government, I needed to go away because we had an untenable situation where people treated me like I must be a bad person because I'm always asking questions. Well, by the way, the fact that I asked questions helped my constituents elect me to the legislature. So I got there, and I decided I'm going to turn over a new leaf. These people don't know me. They don't know how much my city council hates me for asking questions. I get to start fresh. I was not there very long before the same kind of thing happened. And all I did, there's such intimidation on, I'm just explaining, all the legislators get this kind of mentality where if you're the one who has to raise your hand and stand at your microphone, eventually what happened is the Democrats would stand up and oppose me because I was trying to speak. And eventually after that, we went to a different level where the Republicans would come over to my desk and say, do you have to talk? If you talk, then you're going to make all them want to talk again. And we're trying to shut down the debate. Can you please sit down? And this is very frustrating. I'm telling you, the citizens are faced with the exact same question. People are asking us, can you please sit down? And we have to say, no, I have a higher obligation. I will not sit down when we need to question the march in the long direction going off the edge of the cliff. So I'd like to ask you about your chapter on etiquette, because we need to learn how to be polite and responsible. Yet, there were times when I would be debating people, either on the House floor or on the radio, and they would rudely interrupt me, talk over me, and then I'm confronted with the question, what do I do? Okay, here are my options. I can either keep talking, and then nobody hears either one of us, or I can be polite, and all they'll hear is the comments of the left, and I'll look like some kind of coward. How do you handle those situations?
I think the first answer is always awareness, being aware that whatever the topic is, you just gave a great example. If you just even turn down the volume on your television when you're watching one of those shows where you've got liberals and conservatives, conservatives on the same panel, if you just turn down the volume and just watch the body language, you'll almost invariably see that the leftist is in an aggressive posture. They're usually interrupting, they're over-talking. The left has learned to do that. Remember, these are people who don't value good citizenship, okay? What they value is getting their way. And so you're right. It puts us in a bind. We're either going to feel rude ourselves, or we're going to give in. And so I think the first step is being aware that what we're doing isn't working. Now, granted, we have to use some judgment. We have to figure out the specifics of the situation. But in general, what I would say is there are several options there. One of them, by the way, and this is where it's going to take some getting used to, it's going to feel uncomfortable when a liberal interrupts, one option is to simply remind them. I mean, what I talked about using escalating tactics. So the lowest level, the least threatening tactic is to say, just hold on there, let me ask you to let me finish what I'm saying. When you interrupt, then the people out here can't hear our points. So call them on it. Call them on it in a very appropriate way. Call them in a polite way. Now, if they continue to do it, call them on it again. I've asked you repeatedly to stop interrupting me. In other words, bring it out. Don't just back down. Bring it out. Call them on it. And then, the third time, if they continue to do it, you mention something that's going to be strange, and that's just going to continue talking. Now, you're right. Nobody's going to hear anything then. But what you're doing is sending the liberal a message. The appeasement cycle days are over. I'm not going to back down. And then you can turn around and blame them for the chaos because they were behind it. You basically say, now see, we were both talking at the same time. Nobody could hear anything we're saying. Can we reach an agreement here that you talk and I'll talk and we won't talk at the same time? The whole point there is call them out on it. Call them on their tactic. Bring it to the awareness of the audience because fairness is on our side there. The audience sitting there watching that, if you help them see it, if you label it for them, they're going to say, well, person A was interrupting. Person A was over-talking. And person B, eventually they see that person B is just trying to stand up for themselves. But if we do what we've always done, we let them interrupt. Watch it. I'd ask your listeners to really watch this when there's a debate on television. When the liberal interrupts, the conservative almost invariably politely shuts down and waits for their turn. And that we've just got to break that dynamic.
Excellent. So you say no enemies on the right. How is that possible, or why do you even think that could be possible?
Well, it's a difficult one. I have trouble practicing this myself because the left is very unified. Now, the left used to not be unified years ago. You know, you had the union movement, you had the Marxist movement, you had those calling for violent revolution, you had the Fabian socialists basically saying, wait a minute, socialism will happen gradually, we don't have to have a violent revolution. The left was divided, but they had a motto, and that motto was no enemies on the left. And that's what made the left's long march so successful. They continued to push. They began to realize that Western Europe and America were accepting socialism on the gradual installment plan. So they kind of came together. You don't see the left turn on their own. You won't see a liberal go to another liberal, like your example about the legislature or the city council. You won't see a liberal go to another liberal and say, you need to stop interrupting people. I mean, they hang together. So I know it's a hard teaching. It's a hard thing to think about. But I think the conservative movement, because we're more principled to begin with, we've got all kinds of different principles. You've got social conservatives, you've got libertarians, there's all kinds of differences. But right now, I think we're in such a desperate situation that we have to realize, just as our founder said, we're either going to hang together or we're going to hang separately. And so that's when I say, if someone is working, for example, for the repeal of Obamacare, then to the extent that they're working for the repeal of Obamacare, I may disagree with them on some other issues. I may disagree with them on a tactical approach to different things. But if they are working for the repeal of Obamacare, I will cooperate with them and not undermine them. And that's all I mean. I realize we've got to have our debates. We've got to stand for our principles. I'm not calling for selling out, obviously. But what I'm saying is I think the left uses our principled independence on the right. They use that against us. They try to keep us divided. They try to keep the Tea Party divided. They try to keep social conservatives divided from economic conservatives. I think on those areas where we can agree, government is too intrusive. Government is too concentrated at the federal level, and it needs to be pushed back to the state level. Taxes are too high. Regulation is stifling business. Our schools aren't teaching what they need to be teaching. They're not preparing students for a complex world. I think where we can agree, then that's what I mean when I say no enemies on the right. I would never say, for example, that a social conservative should give up on social issues because libertarians may not be interested in that. So, yeah, have that debate, have that argument. But where we can unite, I think we need to unite. The good news is I'm beginning to see signs of that around the nation. I'm seeing more of a willingness of conservatives to say, well, let's kind of get together and talk about what we agree on and concentrate more on that and less on what we disagree on, because that'll take care of itself. We'll have our debates. We'll have our primaries. We'll see who wins.
I just got an email yesterday about Karl Rove pledging to take out conservatives in the Republican Party. You've got people like John McCain who told Todd Akin he would not be seated in the Senate if he even won his election. Then you've got Republican U.S. senators like Jim Talent and John Ashcroft, who claims to be a Christian, who opposed Todd Akin and told him get out of the race. And so can you talk about political parties just for 1 minute? Because I don't see how conservatives can win when we now have Republicans and Democrats who are joining up on the big government agenda. There are a few Republicans who are still very good at wanting there are still some good Republicans out there who would like to see a smaller government, more limited government, and more free market government, but they are a minority. And the Republicans who wanted those principles and even wanted to be constitutional have always been in a minority. So how do the, can you comment on how we are to interpret the difference between political parties and candidates who stand for principles?
Certainly. When I'm speaking to groups around the country, I very deliberately talk about liberal versus conservative or mainstream versus liberal. I'm very careful when I talk about party differences because it's not the same. Everybody assumes Republicans are conservative. That's not necessarily the case, as you're pointing out. I actually had someone in an audience recently challenge me when I talked about liberal initiatives, and the first one was bailouts. And the guy stood up and said, wait a minute, well, the first bailout was from Bush. I said, I'm talking about conservative versus liberal, not Democrat versus Republican. The left has made such strides that a lot of their principles are accepted even by people in the Republican Party. So if the Tea Party became a party, then you begin to have primaries, you begin to have power struggles, you begin to have all the organizational issues. I just think what we need to do, and this is, it's delicate to say, but let me just say it as best I can. I hear people in the Tea Party say, we need to take over the Republican Party. And my answer to them when I'm in private with them is, okay, don't talk about that. Just do it. Okay? Get active. Don't show up and say, we're here to take over, because all you're going to do is create a big visible fight, and you're going to create threat, and you're going to create resistance. So what you do is you get everybody that you know in the Tea Party, and we show up and say, I understand you need some help at the precinct level. I understand you need some folks to run for city council. You show up, you help out, and the numbers eventually shift the political philosophy. I've been a part of that. I've been a part of that. I won't go into detail, but in our county party many, many years ago, we built up a conservative base, and the conservative base came in and helped out and volunteered, and eventually we had a much more conservative county party. Now, we never talked about taking it over. We never made it an us versus them. So I think we need to be strategic in our thinking. So that's the first thing. Secondly, and this gets much more down to tactics, there are politicians who carry a pocket full of dried grass so they can tell which way the wind blows, right?
Right.
I think a lot of the people that you're talking about are just terrified of what will happen if we stand on principle. And it's because the left dominates our cultural institutions. So they say, well, wait a minute, I may agree with you in principle, but my goodness, we can never win. So don't talk about repealing Obamacare because it'll never happen. We'll just get crucified if we try to appeal. So I think some of them may share some of our beliefs, and these are the ones we can reach. We can't reach all of them.
Well, that's excellent, and I am so grateful that we had an opportunity to get enlightened by you today. Can you give us, do you have a website that you like people to go to if they want to learn more?
Actually, they can follow me on Twitter if they want to. They can follow me on Twitter at TCDWriter. And that's just my initials, TCD, and then Writer on Twitter. And if they're interested in these ideas and want to hear more about it, the best way to do it is go to a bookstore or go online and buy Waking the Sleeping Giant, How Mainstream Americans Can Beat Liberals at Their Own Game.
Is there one last parting thought you want us to make sure we remember after you leave?
My parting thought is don't give up the fight. America is not finished yet. This is a strong country. We have been through crises before. Cynthia, the most common question I get when I'm giving speeches is it too late for America? Have we gone downhill too far? And I think that's dangerous. I don't think it's over. I don't think we've got a lot of time. I think the conservative movement has to wake up and get involved and go on offense. But this is a strong country. Our foundation is still pretty strong. I think we can turn it. We're just going to have to think long-term and stop being the summer tourists of politics.
Nice. Well, thank you so much. I'm glad you could be on our show today. It really means a lot. Will you come on our show again sometime?
I would love to. I enjoy talking to you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Are you writing another book?
I am considering another book on what we just talked about, the need for a long-term conservative strategy and what that would look like. It's just after finishing a book, there's a period where you just don't want to write for a while.
I totally understand, but we will be waiting and looking forward to your next writings, and I appreciate you writing for WorldNet Daily and Town Hall and all the other magazines. Thank you for being a beacon of light in the cultural darkness, and I hope we get to talk to you again sometime. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
This has been another edition of Homefront on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I'm Cynthia Davis and hope you enjoyed our program. Please join us next week when we offer another infusion of truth, honesty, and solutions that will grow people bigger and shrink government smaller. Thank you for joining us. See you next week.